I'm pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning, Michael.
There really is only one thing that our listeners will want us to talk about today, will want to hear about, and that is our views, what's going on with AUKUS, Australia's involvement in this monumental nuclear-powered submarine strategy involving the United States and the United Kingdom, as well as Australia, announced in San Diego, Southern California, Tuesday, our time just gone. Martin, just as a reminder, and this came out of the media release from the WA Premier and our own Western Australia almost Minister for Defence Industry, Paul Papalia, who are extolling the virtues in many ways of all of the good jobs that are going to come out of this in Western Australia. But it's an interesting process. After AUKUS, first of all, WA is likely to receive more frequent port visits by US nuclear-powered submarines, to be followed by the United Kingdom's extra visits from 2026. In 2027, we're going to have a rotational presence of UK and US nuclear-powered submarines at HMAS Stirling. They'll be, in that sense, based there. And from the early 2030s, Stirling will house Australia's first sovereign, as they call them, SSN capability, Virginia-class submarines, which we're getting from the United States. By the sound of it, about three, possibly up to five. And then in the process over the years ahead into the 40s, the manufacturer of these SSNs for Australia, about eight by the sound of it, a bit confused as to whether they have to get built in the UK or they actually get built in Adelaide or whether it's a bit of both, but at all at a great cost, about which people say you have to put it in some long-term context of what? About $368 billion. Which can be spent on a lot of other things. Martin, a couple of questions. There are so many. We knew something like this was coming. Were you surprised by the announcement? How have you seen the reaction to it so far?
We did know this was coming since the creation of AUKUS and the pivot away from the French submarines. This has been imminent. So that part is not a surprise. I think the price tag, though, just gave us an enormous shock, up to $368 billion, which is just extraordinary and does actually constitute a longer-term recalibration of it, the entire federal budget, because it brings defence spending up significantly as a percentage of the overall budget. So the size is the shock there. But also... this is an enormously long pipeline with a lot of broad, sometimes vague commitments over an extended period of time. So I think all of us should be asking questions. I don't think it's a simple case of do you support it or don't you. I think it's paramount for us to want to know more and to try to understand and hear the government justify such an extraordinary amount of money. And what the problem with defence is, Michael, that you'll be aware of, is that it's usually bipartisan. Now, that has benefits, of course. You don't want radical changes in defence policy or very significant trashing of existing defence arrangements every time the government changes. So that's a good thing. However, it does mean that there's sometimes very little questioning about defence spending and how that's taking place and who's monitoring this for blowouts, because defence is notorious for having some of the biggest problems with procurement and with, transparency in that area. So we should be asking questions. There's extraordinary amounts of money, and it's public money. It's our money that's being spent.
There's the whole question of the cost, what else it could be spent on. There's the whole question of project management, all practical questions. Some of the immediate responses, academic responses, referred to in an article we posted on the Shipping News soon after the announcement was made and headed Critics Surface on AUKUS, Demand a Nuke-Free Cope Hearn Sound. But in the course of that article, pointed out that some serious academics from around the country who look at the question of submarine detection say it might be a dud investment, because the benefit of having these nuclear-powered submarines is they're very stealthy. They can stay down for months and months on end and wreak havoc when they do their work. But if they can be detected, your $368 billion goes down the drain, sinks to the bottom of the harbour, goes down into the deepest trench out in the Indian Ocean. How does one deal with that sort of criticism if you're the government?
Well, I think it feeds into a broader concept, and that's that we know it is these aspects of defence policy are important, but we also know that new technology comes along, new ways of doing things comes along. Even if you go back about 15 years, the emphasis on a lot of our white papers and a lot of our technology was on smaller, agile, flexible, peacekeeping style forces that you could insert on the ground really quickly to solve a spot conflict. Now already, this is something completely different. And our defence environment, our foreign affairs environment, our diplomatic environment, over the next 20 to 30 years, that will continue to evolve very, very quickly and take different dimensions. So the other question to ask is $368 billion for only 8 submarines, is that too much investment into one part of a defence strategy when a whole range of other investments or other dimensions might be very, very important? So there's a lot of different aspects to this particular announcement.
Tied to that broader strategic consideration, Martin, we know, because we also heard about this in recent times since the Albanese government was elected, that the government now has a report from former Foreign Affairs Minister Stephen Smith and Angus Houston, former head of the of our defence establishment, about Australia's future security needs. It hasn't been shown to us yet. If they hadn't canvassed the purchase of these AUKUS nuclear-powered submarines, which they inevitably will have because there was an announcement, as you've said, made by the Morrison government, it must have nonetheless constrained what they've got to say.
Well, you make an excellent point. It's basically putting the cart before the horse. So normally your review makes recommendations and you act on those recommendations. In this case, we've got really significant announcement with a suite of expenditure that precedes the release of that review. So we can probably expect that review comes to the conclusion that these submarines are needed, but it is a strange way to do things. Normally you do it the other way around. Probably in terms of timing in defence of the government, they might be, it's a contractual arrangement, so maybe they need to sign the contract for the very earliest of these submarines, otherwise the timeline gets pushed out further and further. It's already a long timeline, long pipeline, so maybe that's what they would lean on, but it is certainly unusual to have the announcement precede the review release.
I start to wonder whether we'll actually see the Smith-Houston report at all.
Well, I mean, some people might say it's a bit redundant, but it is actually important because, firstly, your decisions need to be based off good advice and good analysis. And presumably, this advice and analysis is forthcoming because we haven't seen it yet. And that's that's the concern that we just talked about there is, how do we know that we're taking exactly the right approach? Because we haven't seen useful advice and analysis that tells us the subs are the be-all and end-all for our defence security over the next 30 years.
Martin, another very fundamental principled reaction, which is coming from many quarters, it's coming from, you might say, those with particular religious faith and outlook, those with a very strategic, pragmatic approach to it, and that's the sort of sentiment that the article I mentioned carried forward. To this effect, Professor Matt Fitzpatrick at Flinders University contends that by these AUKUS arrangements, Australia has effectively ceded to the United States its capacity to make serious decisions about war and peace. He says we've wedded ourselves to a risky US policy on China and turned a deaf ear to the region. And of course, we've heard former Prime Minister Paul Keating come out and make a lot of noises which might be thought to that effect. He's been damned with faint praise by the Prime Minister and senior ministers, but one would suggest that the point that Professor Fitzpatrick makes is an important one. What do you think?
And it is a really interesting one, and it's something completely different from what we've talked about so far. We've mainly talked about logistics, we talked about investment, we talked about strategy, but this one talks to broader concepts as to who we're lining up with and how our decisions are seen in the region. So we do have that long-standing military alliance with the US, so this doesn't change that. AUKUS itself was a major strategic move, so that's already preceded this decision. But this does lock us into that Anglosphere. We are seen as perhaps an outpost of the US and the UK, and that can constrict us in Asia, where a lot of work has been done over the last 30-odd years to reconceptualize Australia as not just an outpost of, say, the US or UK, but a legitimate player in the area that seeks to engage. And in particular, we've sought to build relationships with Indonesia, with Japan, trade relationships with countries like Vietnam that had not existed as strongly in the past. And the thing that might concern some of us is how some of these relationships are reinterpreted in the light of this announcement. So again, some of those allies, some of those other players in the regions will have seen this coming perhaps, but it may reinforce traditional notions about where Australia stands rather than us, because we're geographically located in Asia and so much of our trade is taking place in Asia. It's not just a question about China. It's a question about Southeast Asia. It's a question about East Asia. It's a question about South Asia, Japan, and India and other players like that. So all of those relationships are quite important to us going forward.
Some interesting comments made locally. For example, Adrian Glamorgan, who's a Fremantle resident, a man who I've met. He's also secretary of the Friends World Committee, the Quakers, in the Asia Pacific. And Adrian says, security comes from trust and independence, not talking up fear. We need shared security in our region, and that comes from growing diplomacy, increasing foreign aid in our region, creating educational opportunities and building understanding between nations. The money that's going into some far-off submarines is better spent on creating a better Asia West Pacific, built on trust, not on fear. And that's reflected in other people's comments who are worried as well that all we've done is make Perth, well, let's be more specific about it, Fremantle a target in the event of a real war, because HMAS Stirling might, like Pearl Harbor, get some attention.
Yeah, and I think this goes back to that level of expenditure in this announcement and whether it could be spent better elsewhere. Just think about how many thousands of people you could send into Asia to train, to learn, to make connections. Think about how many more thousands of people you could bring to Australia for short-term training or benefits out of a price tag of $368 billion. Now, it may not, but let's say it was half that, $170 or $80 billion. I think it's about more like $190 billion that you might actually spend on other things. And those, I mean, we still have very low levels, for instance, of Bahasa, which is studied in Australia, and that should change. We don't study Mandarin nearly as much as we should. These sorts of things are really important tools in contributing to knowledge and understanding, but they also give us, they're also soft assets for us when tricky times arrive, because you want people who can speak foreign languages, for instance. So there's a lot of different dimensions to this which are worth us discussing and giving thought to.
Martin, the high profile attack on the AUKUS deal, as I mentioned a bit earlier, came from Paul Keating, the former Australian Prime Minister, man with the most acerbic tongue I think I've ever come across. Sometimes I wish I could emulate that, but probably it's best that we leave it to Paul Keating. But he labelled the AUKUS submarine plan as the worst deal in all history and the worst international decision by a Labor government since Billy Hughes tried to introduce conscription. Billy Hughes's decision was well before all of us, including Paul Keating, but it was just over 100 years ago and really caused a divide, and he was booted out of the Labor Party at the time, from memory. But Paul Keating got fairly stuck in. Was it a helpful contribution?
Look, and I'm a bit of you know, I always found Paul Keating incredibly fascinating too, and one of the greatest orators Australia's ever seen. Can be a bit potty-mouthed at times, and visceral. Look, I think he makes some legitimate criticisms. Now, people will point out that he's got business ties, et cetera, to China. I don't know the extent of that, and maybe should declare those. But that doesn't mean that some of the criticisms that he might raise aren't, you know, well understood. So, yes, Keating kept close ties with the US as prime minister. But one thing Keating did talk about a lot was Asian engagement. He didn't get along with everyone, Mahathir in Malaysia, for instance. But he did build a lot of ties in Asia and sought to reconceptualize our role in Asia. So it's not that surprising that he would have those objections for all those reasons we just talked about. Are we throwing away decades of diplomacy by presenting ourselves as a military outpost for the US in particular? And the thing about the US is we know that US foreign policy has had a lot of mixed success over time. It has been quite interventionist. And he also talks about the colonial aspect. So you only have to go back 50 years, which is not that long in people's memories, for a South and Southeast Asia to be dominated by colonial powers and the resentment that comes with that. So military buildup by colonial powers is not well received in the region. That doesn't mean that they like China necessarily either. I think that they would be upset or concerned about military buildup on both sides. So it does contribute sometimes to tensions in the region.
Back in the Cold War days and before that, reminding you, Martin, and listeners, because context is important on most occasions, I was born in 1950. I grew up being very well of a communist threat, not only within Australia or in unions and the Labor Party split, but also the growth of the Soviet Union. And when I was a kid, China was, as it currently is, the People's Republic. It was a brand new thing, Red Star over China. It only happened a year or two before I was born, and there was this demonic institution, you know, China, and another one, the USSR. And if you ever expressed anything that looked like you were trying to understand their point of view, you'd be accused of being a fellow traveller. And that's sort of implicit in what we've got today. With what's happening, I really do fear we go into a Cold War period again. We're talking nuclear, been remembering Hiroshima and Nagasaki, everything that people seem to fight for as we young teenagers first and then young adults fought for, sort of peace in the world. Seems to me that there's a real danger we could slip back into a Cold War mentality with all the diplomatic problems attendant with it. Am I too alarmist?
Well, I think you raise a good point. It's good that we're honing in on China here, because there is that possibility that people see this as a new Cold War. And I would be really disappointed by that, because it's not that we should gloss over any human rights failings human rights abuses in China, because they exist. But if you think about human rights abuses exist in many parts of the world. And singling out one power over another and making that one power seem as the bogeyman and placing us into different camps in relation to that one power is actually a dangerous and, I think, a backward move. And you only have to look at Australia, that has this really comprehensive military alliance with the US, but a very strong trade alliance with China, to see that it should be much more complex than this. And the Albanese government, to give them some credit, had worked to build up, rebuild that relationship with China somewhat after it'd been in the freezer for, you know, 5 or 6 years, and so much so that they'd cracked down on some of their exports. And, you know, I don't think that's a good move from on their behalf, but I think that dialogue and engagement can be helpful in rebuilding trust. It doesn't mean that you have to agree with everything another government's doing, but if you're talking to them, that's not a bad thing. It usually diffuses tensions. So I think we do need to have a relationship with China. It needs to be eyes wide open. It doesn't mean that we have to agree with everything they say, but I think actually that they're probably not expecting that. They're probably expecting that we're working with them. We might need to push back occasionally on with them, but I think overall, having a good economic relationship and perhaps two-way people movement, et cetera, can be helpful and healthy.
China's been an amazing civilization, as we all know, for a long, long time, predating most European, if not all European civilizations, the United States and the world. And we've all known since I was a kid that China was coming from the back starter blocks at the races and was going to hit the front and streak ahead. There seems to be something to me that's quite unrealistic about the reaction we're seeing to China, that we somehow think that we can constrain its economic development, its place in the world, and the influence it's going to have in international affairs. Why aren't we facing up to China more obviously than we seem to be, or are we?
Well, I think that any talk of constraining China is plainly ridiculous, just as talk of containing communism was rather ridiculous in the time. And if you go through most historians, political scientists and the like, and they look at the so-called containment strategy, I mean, they were treating communism like they treated disease or an epidemic. Communism is an idea, so you can't treat it in the same way. And I think trying to constrain China only causes resentment and angst. So like I said, it doesn't mean you have to accept everything that you're doing, but I think if you welcome Chinese engagement in a variety of areas and try to support that and find collaborative areas to work with them on, I think that you have a much more nuanced approach to your relationship with China. And that's got to be the way forward. It's got to be you find those common areas and you work towards those. And you see how you make that relationship work. Try and tell our export-focused farmers that we shouldn't have a trade relationship with China. You know, there's a lot of different types of communities and sections of our economy that really need that. And actually, if you're thinking about from the other end, you're actually helping a whole range of people in China have a better lifestyle and have a better way of living by working collaboratively with them as well.
Martin, it struck me the other day, having identified myself as the classic baby boomer, that the PMs and senior ministers damning with faint praise Paul Keating was really an illustration of the decline of the influence of the baby boomers. I'm not sure what particular generational category the current cabinet and the opposition leadership fall into, but they're not baby boomers. It looks to me as if there's a new generational thought here as to how the world works, wherever all of those ideas have come from. You're, let me say, probably part of that generation. What are my granddaughters going to be thinking about and looking at, do you reckon, in 20, 25 years' time, if all of this AUKUS goes to plan, all of these nuclear-powered submarines have arrived here, challenges in dealing with the nuclear waste, maintaining a nuclear industry to support them, and everything happens apparently according to the current plan. How different are things going to be for that coming generation?
Well, I mean, I'd probably offer a couple of thoughts that in 25 to 30 years, we're still likely to have a military relationship with the US, but China's not going away. They'll still be with us and they'll still be having a really major role. They might have a more enhanced role in the Asia Pacific. So that's the longer term outlook. and other countries. Think about where India might be in 25 to 30 years. Think about where Indonesia could be in 25 to 30 years. They're the big emerging players. So, you know, we and the UK and UK's a long way from us, and they're actually less players in the region in recent times. It's not to say we're seeking a poor relationship with the UK, but you wouldn't be basing your defence relationship around the UK, and you would need a nuanced foreign policy that's much broader than that with our former colonial friends. So I think that if you're thinking down the track, Asia and the Asia Pacific is absolutely where it's going to be at.
Martin, we'll draw this beginning of a long conversation about security. We'll see the Smith-Houston report before long, hopefully. But of course, we're assuming that the AUKUS plans come to fruition. We're assuming it's a done deal, but it has to get approval in the US Congress. It has to pass the Australian Parliament, and that, not the least, would include getting the budget through with all the numbers in it. And it would have to pass the UK Parliament. Is there any danger that it might come unstuck?
I think in terms of the parliamentary process, I think it's a fairly safe bet. And the reason is that here in the Australian Parliament, it will have strong support from the Liberal Party, Liberal National Party, and that will ensure passage through both houses of Parliament. The budget, this is a 30-year project with the budget, so a lot of it's not going to become evident straight away. It'll take, you know, 5 to 10 years for some of this expenditure to come through. The UK Parliament, I think, is quite bipartisan around this as well. And I don't expect too many changes. Labor's already said that they're very supportive of it and they're in opposition in the UK. The US is a fascinating body because, this is our mainstay in terms of security, but US politics is frayed in a lot of recent times. And there are significant numbers of isolationists, particularly in the Republican Party, who are less interested in bolstering relationships with allies, more nationalist in terms of sharing intelligence and military software and hardware. That could be an issue down the track. So stay tuned there. I think that there's still Republicans that are very supportive of our relationship, plenty of Democrats too, but US politics has been very fluid lately and it's become less predictable.
Martin, on that note, it's been a fascinating discussion. I'm sure Australians are going to continue to talk very much about it. And to open up all of those other issues as you've opened them up this morning, I think people are going to find really helpful. So thanks. Have a great week. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Michael. A great conversation.